Welcome to the Tech and Main Presents podcast with your host, Sean St. Hill. Sean is the CEO of Tech and Main, a technology consulting firm in Atlanta, Georgia. Listen in as thought leaders share their tips and insights about what's going on in the world of technology. And now, here's your host, Sean St. Hill.
Thank you for joining another episode of Tech and Main Presents, where we bring you the best insights from today's leaders and experts in technology. Today, we will be speaking for a second time with Ryan Chapman. Ryan is a principal incident response and forensics consultant for BlackBerry. He's also an author, instructor, and conference organizer. Ryan, welcome back to the Tech and Main Presents podcast.
Hey, Sean, thank you for having me. Excited to be back and ready to engage in another round of ransomware-focused conversation.
My man, that's what I love to hear. So as you know, we recently recorded, and I say recently, within the last 6 months or so, we recorded what I consider to be the best episode ever on ransomware. And that was what the episode was titled. And it is currently firmly the third most listened to podcast in Tech and Main Presents podcast history. So thank you for all those wonderful listeners that consumed that content. Hopefully it has been useful to you. And so really, we're bringing you round two. I'd reached out to Ryan recently, and there were some things that had been coming across my radar. And I was like, you know what? I really want to talk about this. And what better way to do it than on the podcast? And who better to do it with than Ryan? So Ryan and I are going to jump into a few different topics. But before we do that, Ryan, why don't you give folks a quick update on your bio for those that may not have heard the first episode?
Oh, yeah, sure thing. So my name is Ryan Chapman. I go by RJ underscore Chap, C-H-A-P, online, although I have no idea why, because I do not go by the term or the name RJ. I actually don't like being called RJ. And yet, for 15 plus years now, I've gone by RJ underscore Chap. So whatever there. I've been working in the digital forensics and incident response, or DFIR, as we call it, realm for a little over 10 years, maybe 11-ish years. I've been in consulting. This week, it's been 3 years in direct client consulting with BlackBerry. I was hired on by Cylance, and we were purchased by BlackBerry. And so I was brought into the BlackBerry security services firm. And so when clients get hit with things like ransomware, it's one of the most common things we deal with, unfortunately, for everyone involved, they come to us and then we help them out. So that's I deal with ransomware day in, day out. I've also authored a course for the SANS Institute that is known as Forensics 528, Ransomware for Incident Responders. It's a 4-day course, and its entire purpose is to train people to prevent, in a way, but mostly detect, and detect by hunting and or respond to ransomware threat actors within their environments. So the whole idea is the hands-on, low-level forensic data you need to obtain, acquire, how you parse that data to make sense out of it, how you analyze that data to, well, make sense out of the attack, and so on and so forth. These are the things I do all the time. And I also help organize a conference called CactusCon. So last we spoke, I may still have been the official lead for the conference. I have now transitioned to the sponsor slash, general liaison. So my goal now is to continue to advocate the conference like I'm doing right now. Come check out CactusCon. January 27th to 28th, 2023, and work with sponsors to get sponsors into the conference. So I have, we in our community often say, I wear multiple hats, you know, and it's because we do. So I was trying to avoid that phrase, and there I just said it anyway. So yeah, a lot of things on my plate, but ransomware is first and foremost. And I basically live, breathe, eat, sleep, all the above. 7 days a week, I deal with it in some way, shape, or form.
Which again makes you the perfect person to talk about what we're going to get into over the next however many minutes. And so, as I alluded to, let me step back for a second. So one of the industries or types of organizations that I have a passion for is K-12 and higher ed, specifically K-12. And that's because I have a wife that is an elementary school teacher, and we also have a daughter who is in her second year of high school, right? And so as a result, being the tech nerd that I am, when you think about cybersecurity and technology, we realize the education space, one, is typically severely underfunded. And because they are typically underfunded, that in turn makes them a very likely target for ransomware and other types of technology attacks. And so what Ryan and I are actually going to talk about is kind of a debrief or a post-incident analysis, depending on how you want to look at it, of a college in Normal, Illinois. It's Heartland Community College. And what I want to do is preface everything that we're about to say with the fact that what Ryan and I are looking at are public-facing documents, right? So we don't know any of the leadership. You know, we have not been privy to any internal documents or information. Everything that we have access to is publicly available, Google, blogs, what have you. So with that said, what we're going to do is we're going to actually, well, Ryan primarily is going to help kind of deconstruct the cyber attack that Heartland had maybe a year or two ago. And so, Ryan, with that, let's jump into talking about Heartland Community College.
Okay, sounds good. So first and foremost, I don't have the forensic details from the case. That's not been made public, and nor should it, the full details ever be made public. You really don't want to release all of that. However, what I do know is that it is an ongoing problem for any educational institution at all, you know, stages, K through 12, secondary, you know, whatever it may be, even vocational, all the above, that ransomware is coming in, destroying the institution's ability to provide their services. Education may not be one of those threat to human lives in the immediate sense, of course, but to me, it's still a massive, massive problem. And one of the industries that is especially targeted often that just bothers me beyond belief. And that, I think that comes from personally having my graduate degree. I spent 7 years in college. You know, I was working full time and I had to get that extra seventh year to get my, you know, my master's degree. But man, oh man, the tension, the amount of work, it was just, so much. And I can only imagine the impact that something like this would have, not just to the school board, you know, all the above, but also to the students. It's like, are you seriously? What? And scheduling and, oh, the nightmares. So they were hit by, Heartland Community College was hit by a group that goes by the name PYSA, or PYSA, P-Y-S-A. So they're using the term PYSA, which typically refers to, well, let me get the actual definition so I don't say something silly here. But basically, a Mexican national is where it's usually used from, although other Latin countries use it too. So I'm from a small farming community, and we had guys who called themselves PYSAs all the time. And when I read the ransomware team name the first time, I was like, is that me when I think it does? And then when I went to their data leak site, they've actually got like a little guy with a sombrero. And I was like, oh, it is. That is what they mean. So the PYSA crew, one of the things that they're just, how dare they? There's an article on, this is Blue Voyant, and it's called School Days, the Evolving Ransomware Threat Landscape, Credential Breaches, and Other Online Threats Facing Universities and Colleges. The title is quite the mouthful, but the article goes on to list in 2021 alone, just from the PYSA crew, we've got 9 institutions listed here, one of them being Heartland Community College. They were going heavily after these organizations. Now, here's the deal. I don't have the threat intelligence right now to know how much they may have been targeting colleges or universities or even educational institutions overall. But what I do know is that many threat actors choose to target them if they make that actual decision. And it's not just kind of a wide net approach and they pull these in because exactly what you said, they're grossly underfunded. The K through 12 and many public universities are grossly underfunded. And they don't have the ability to bring in folks such as everyone listening to this podcast right now, most likely. You know, many of you out there work in IT. And I work as a cyber responder. I just made that term up. I don't like that. I don't like cyber responder. Let's go with just incident responder, right? When something hits the fan, okay, sure, we come in. Now, technically, I don't want them to have to be able to pay for someone like me and pay our, you know, we're not a cheap date. I want them to be able to have the preparation and the defense and overall prevention mechanisms that would prevent a lot of this from happening. But unfortunately, it doesn't quite work that way. Another thing that schools such as Heartland have against themselves, really kind of working against them, I should say, is that their user base is very, very distributed for the most part. You've got students of all walks and they are using computing devices from all over the place. Any type of online learning environment where they're connecting to an LMS, a learning management system, or LMS, which you should never call it, you're engaging with all these outside entities and you are losing the ability to a degree to lock down the hosts, the endpoints, which are one of the most vulnerable things in the organization. The number one vulnerable being the people. And in this case, it ends up being students. So it's very hard to protect your home base because your home base is all over the place. So when the PISA crew came in this particular example, I still wasn't able to actually find via a couple of days looking around the exact entry vector for Heartland's incident. But what I do see is that they were using, they were allotted some monies. I'll call it monies. Some finances were set aside, $1 million in the next budget year to further security and improvements and enhancements. And one of the things they're focusing on, aside from their backup systems, which is a decent chunk of that money, is improvements. It says right here from a quote, the key is to be as proactive as we can and mitigate the potential for future attacks through new systems with regard to filters for email systems that catch things quicker. And then there's more to the quote. I'll digress there. So there's a mention of email filters. PISA loves to use email. They also come in via remote desktop protocol that should not be open in many cases to the internet, and it is, and that leads to problems. But in this case, many colleges, another problem they run into is that when they're hit with ransomware, does it actually originate with an employee or does it originate with the general user? And again, those users can be the entire student base, right? So in this particular attack, I don't have the specifics of what the PISA team did, but we have a bunch of different things we could talk about. We can talk about how PISA works. I've worked many of their cases. We can talk about some of the things they were doing with the $1 million that were set aside. We can also talk about the fact that they got $1 million after the fact and why that occurred. I mean, first off, duh, but why that really occurred and how that can actually be an advantage in a sick and twisted way for organizations who have been hit by ransomware to basically take those opportunities and to capitalize on whatever positives there are. And then, you know, kind of just go from there. So where do you want to meander?
So let's start in the reverse, right? Because I do want to say and really give a shout out to the leadership at Heartland Community College for a couple of reasons, maybe more than a couple, but in no particular order. One, not retreating behind public relations speak and saying, you know, it's an ongoing investigation, we can't really say anything, contact our public relations agency for more information, right? They didn't do that. So kudos for not hiding behind a press release or some sort of news alert. Secondly, having the CIO kind of come back to the board about a year later to give an update, right, I think is something else that's also commendable. They're owning it, but then they're also holding IT accountable for providing updates. I'll stop there because I think that's at least something that I wanted to mention. Like, we're not trying to throw Heartland Community College under the bus. I mean, if anything, they are being as forthright as they can, and they're allowing us to be able to kind of dissect things. So let's touch on that. And then definitely, I think it would be good for our audience to hear from you, Ryan, on PISA and what engagements and interactions with them have looked like.
Yes, I like that. I like that you took the human approach. Let's go with that first. So also kudos and shout outs to their entire organization and being transparent about what they're doing going forward. Many people read these news articles. Now, bear with me. Okay, bear with me for a moment before you're like, wait, what did you just say? Many people will. I'm not saying they should. I'm just saying that they will. They will read news such as an article I'm looking at. Heartland Community College budgets $1 million for cybersecurity after ransom attack. They will take that in a negative way. I see that in a massively positive fashion. I see that as, oh, awesome. They realize now, oh my goodness, this not only can happen to us, it has, and it will never again, right? So not only do they allocate that budget, and I have to assume, I don't know, but for a community college, $1 million out of a budget is a decent chunk, right? So they're taking this amount of money and they're also being transparent about what they're using it for. They're referencing directly that implementing a new backup system that was planned before the attack, but ended up being moved up. They're, by the way, them saying that is their acknowledgement that they had something, quote unquote, on the docket, if you will, right? In their to-do list, it didn't get done. And then bad stuff happened, right? That is almost every single client. Let me rephrase that. I cannot recall a single client who has not told me some piece of equipment, some service, some whatever it was that was in some way, shape, or form related to a ransomware attack that I've worked or that our team has worked, that there were not plans for it in some way, shape, or form. It's many times a budgetary restriction, right? You either don't have, it's all based on money. You don't have the time, which means you really don't have the people or the money, right? You don't have the equipment, which means you don't have the money. It all comes down to time and money, which is in essence, it's all money, right? It's how we work our economy. So they're coming out and they're saying like, look, here's the deal. This is what we're doing. This is what is going to happen going forward. Another thing that I really like from the perspective of, I live in a world of zeros and ones, and I often have to like, pull away and be like, oh yeah, people, there's humans involved, I guess, sure. Let's deal with humans. Okay. So there was also, at first, no evidence of personal data getting out, right? Student data, for example, personally identifiable information, PII. Later, there was a group that was brought in, Tetra Defense, and they're a firm very similar to what I do at day job with BlackBerry, right? They come in. They also handle security monitoring for organizations and things of that nature. Great firm from what I've heard, by the way. They were involved with this. They actually found, there was student data that was mentioned. In fact, the PISA crew put up on their data leaks site some information pertaining to, hey, guess what? This is actually what we got. Their response was not to try to snuff that out, but rather their response was, okay, we have people directly outside of our organization who are affected. For a fact, right? Officially, per this document that I'm reading, 3,983 people. Let's just round that up to 4,000 and call it a ballpark in general, right? So what do? They reached out to Experian, one of the three major credit reporting agencies in the United States, and they have a system called IdentityWorks Credit 3B. Okay, I'm not familiar with 3B. I just realized that part was on there, but they provided this service for a year to all of these people. And by providing that service, they're showing the people that they're actually concerned that their attack, I have too many theirs, right? But the attack on the school might then further harm their student base. And they don't want that, right? So they're providing these as a means for the people and the humans to have a modicum of protection. And it's not just a modicum. Personally, I'm a big fan of credit monitoring services. That's not a selling thing. I don't work for any of them. I pay for one myself, which funny enough, actually is Experian. I recently bought a car and I buy a car like every 10 years. We drive until the wheels fall off. You know what I'm saying? And my wife's car, her wheels almost fell off. So we bought a car and I immediately got a little ding on my phone. I was like, hey, what's going on with your credit profile? And I was like, thank you, Experian. Like, you know what I mean? I don't care if you go with Experian or any company, but I do recommend those in general. And the fact that they provided that to the humans, to the people, says a lot. They really wanted those people to have further protections and were taking that on as a, you know, as someone in the 90s would say, our bad. Sorry, our bad. And they're trying to rectify it as they can. And I really, really appreciate not only Heartland being as transparent as they have been, but any institution that does as such. If we all, the royal we, if we all clam up and we hide what's happened. If we don't even report, hey, by the way, we were attacked with ransomware, like sucks for us, right? If we don't do that, then the overall attacks continue to grow and grow and grow. They continue to move on and move on and move on. And they don't even have to evolve because we don't have eyes on exactly what's happening. We don't have researchers that are looking into the malware specimens that are used to create signatures for them, to enhance machine learning detections, to identify them, like what we do, you know, at BlackBerry. Whatever it is, we're just allowing it to happen and we're sweeping it under the rug. The more groups that come out and say, hey, this happened, it sucked. Here's how bad it sucked. That's amazing. Just amazing, especially when they tell their story of really how bad it sucked from a human perspective. We worked 20-hour days. We had cots brought in. I missed my brother's wedding. Like, you know, whatever these things are, we have to truly understand that impact. And the only way is for this type of reporting to occur.
Ryan, I could not agree more. When I look at, and again, admitted tech nerd, right? Been there, bought the t-shirt, got a tattoo on the, you know, upper left shoulder. I'm a tech nerd, and I don't apologize for that in any way, shape, or form. One of the things that I consume and inhale is statistics. And when you talk about, you know, we're not going to go over to healthcare or financial services. We're just going to stay right there with educational organizations. It is a low number, something like 20 to 30%. The actual data breaches or data incidents that occur actually end up getting reported. There's a gentleman that we had on the podcast a little while ago. He's the chief information officer for a college down in Texas. They had a data breach during the pandemic, and he came on the podcast and talked about it and talked through it. And honestly, and this is going to sound a little corny, but that type of thing moves me. Because what it does is it shows vulnerability. And to the extent that we are vulnerable and we share the information, look, Illuminate is a software provider, you know, for a number of large school districts. They had a data breach recently, third party, you know, supply chain type of thing. Schools in California were affected. Schools in New York were affected. One of the school districts in New York said it's in our contract for Illuminate to have let us know that this data breach occurred. They didn't. The point is, not knowing is dangerous. It's catastrophic. The more you know, it's not that you're putting yourself out there for embarrassment or to be made fun of. You're actually helping other people. When you do a postmortem and share the fact that, yeah, you know what? They got in through, you know, this old unpatched database or through this old unpatched software, this legacy software that we don't use very much. Okay, now other schools, other companies, other organizations that may have that software or that may have that application can go and do something about it. So I digress, chap, but that's really and so important. You know, whether it's public sector, private sector, we have to share information.
Absolutely. One of my favorite websites, one of my favorite things in the cybersecurity realm outright, let alone being a website, is a website called the DFIR Report. It's the DFIRReport.com. No spaces, all one word. It's a website of volunteers who set up what are known as honeypots, so large network environments that are made to look as though they are real environments, right? And they wait to be attacked. When they are attacked, they then allow the attack to be carried out, right? It's not real data, you know? And then what they do at this group is they report on their analysis and they analyze at the level, I mean, at a level that we do at our firm that we charge a lot of money for it to do, right? It's difficult. It takes a lot and it takes a number of years to learn how to do these types of things. It's all volunteer time. And when you go to this website and they break down how these attacks occur, right, they're sharing information from their honey nets, but the amount of time they put in and what we call the indicators of compromise. So whenever they find something on the disk or over the traverse the network, whether it's IP addresses on the internet, of foreign command and control servers, which what malware and attackers use to control and remotely connect into a network. And whatever it is, they provide these things. The more that we have that type of visibility throughout the overall just general IT, right? The royal we provide that type of data to one another, the better. And most organizations are not willing to do that for many, many reasons. A lot of them come down to legal and privatization, things of that now. But there's also cyber insurance may say, no, you cannot. Many reasons why they may not be able to do so. But many of them simply do not want to do so for fears of looking, you know, basically weak, right? They're that vulnerability, they don't want to put it out there. And that unfortunately creates an environment where we have repeat attacks that are able to be carried out because the visibility is too low. And your number percentage statistic-wise of 20-30%, I've worked so many cases that are never reported. So many cases. The bulk of mine have never been reported that I work personally. And you know, it's not my job to report them, obviously, right? I work with the organizations, their legal counsels, and so on and so forth. But we see so much. And yet, the one thing that's kind of changing this in a way is that the ransomware actors, ever since they've been moving to what we call initially called double extortion, and now I just refer to it as multi-extortion. Since 2019, the first data leak site, or as they may call them, their client portal, which is really cute because they call their victims clients as though they're doing their work for them. That's precious. They're coming out and saying, hey, we've attacked the following organizations, and they're putting your name out there. Once they put your name out there, you then have the decision to pay their ransom or they will actually publish your data. Now, some of them work such that if you pay them quickly enough, they won't even post the information concerning, hey, we broke into so-and-so, we have their data. In those situations, other examples of probably never going to be reported. Potentially never be reported, I should say. In situations where the data gets a note saying, hey, company XYZ, we hit them 2 weeks ago. We have 17 gigabytes of their data, including HR files, including this, including that, how they make their widgets, like the intellectual property and whatever, right? When they post those types of things, at that point, the organizations usually find it fairly difficult to not engage in reporting because researchers like myself, we have aggregate sites that will aggregate all of this data and we see it and go, oh, look, this company got hit. And also, for that matter, you've got folks that are out there who are a little bit less scrupulous, if you will, who will even try to carry out extortion on the companies outside of the ransomware attack. So a ransomware group A comes in, attacks company X, right? Company X then decides, well, we're going to kind of keep this close to our vest. So then what happens is another part of this multi-extortion, right? Another phase of extortion. Not only do we have your network and your host locked down and you have to pay to get access to them, not only might we leak out your data, but for that matter, we're going to start calling your vendors, your partners. We're going to start calling your suppliers. We're going to call all of your joint ventures. We're going to call the governing bodies to whom you must report because of your realm, your vertical, your sector, industry, what have you. So they're really, really going out of their way to make public the fact that they've done what they've done, and that is throwing a wrench into the quiet nature that many organizations have towards these attacks. And that's a great example is with Paisa here. They have a data leak site, and that's actually how I know that Paisa is the one who got into their environment, because I have a screenshot here from Paisa's website that shows their name. And it basically says, we got in there. I'm like, oh, that's who hit them. It was also in another article that I read. And in the article, it says, we got this from Paisa's leak site. So being open and transparent is becoming a little more of a trend, although it's not necessarily by choice. But you know what? In that regard, in that one regard, I'll take it, because that may lead to then disclosing a little bit more about the attack. How did they get in, right? What avenue, what venue? Oh, it was phishing. Well, can you say how? Yeah, they sent a file attachment. Can you say what kind of file? Oh, yeah, it was a .zip file. Can you say what was in that .zip file? Like when someone double-clicked on it, what was in there, right? That's a compressed archive. So what did Windows show the user? Oh, it showed them a .js file. Well, that's a JavaScript file. Did they double-click on that? I hope they didn't. You're like, yeah, they double-clicked on it. So then you go to your email security gateways and you find, can we block zip files outright? For business purposes, probably not. Can we look at zip files that are not encrypted and determine if they contain .js files? Is that a thing that we have the technology to do? And if it is, can we block those? Right? Can we identify known file names associated with this attack? If it's a zip and has a name like this that matches a string or matches what we call a regular expression, meaning a pattern matching type of string analysis, can we block those, right? The more that we share, the more that we know, the better we're going to be prepared. However, of course, ransomware groups, well, I mean, all they do is evolve, right? They constantly, it's a cat and mouse game, but yet we slow them down. And the big thing about cybersecurity is you're never going to keep everyone out. It's not going to happen. I don't care who you are. If someone, a group really wants to get in bad enough, they'll do it. That's why we have what we call the Advanced Persistent Threat, or APT, which are nation state sponsored attack groups. We call them Advanced Persistent Threat. Many times they're quite advanced. Sometimes they're not very advanced, but they are persistent and they will get in, right? So if these groups really want to get in, how do you and your organization keep them out? You raise the cost of them getting into your environment. That's what you do. You make it cost prohibitive on their end. And that cost usually comes down to time and they move on to other targets. That's the whole idea. So, all right, before I keep going down a rabbit hole there, I'll pause.
No, that was actually a nice segue into the part of the conversation that I want to have about PISA themselves. But before we do that, I do want to touch on one other thing from the Heartland Community College attack, and that is understanding that this wasn't Harvard. And that $1 million set aside, I think you touched on this earlier a little bit, like that is no small sum of money, right? And so, Ryan, really talk about the importance of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, something like that. Like you spend $20,000 on the front end so that you don't have to spend $1 million on the back end. Talk about the importance of being proactive as opposed to being reactive.
Yes. As we discussed on the last episode we did together concerning ransomware, when we say ransomware these days, that term does not simply refer to a malware executable, right? A .exe file, typically in a Windows environment that someone double clicks on or somehow otherwise runs on the machine and then does a bunch of bad stuff. That's what we now refer to as the payload, the ransomware payload, or the encryptor itself. Ransomware, at this point, everyone should understand it refers to an entire attack campaign that is usually driven by humans with their hands on the keyboard, which is why we call it human-operated ransomware. I use the acronym HUMOR, H-U-M-O-R. I'm trying to push that one because there's not a standard one, and I like that one. It's not humorous, but it works out really well. So these humans get into your environment. They break in or they pay intrusion access brokers or initial access brokers to get into your environment. And then once they're in the environment, they then manually do all the things that they need to do, right? What it comes down to is not only is prevention critical and always has been, but the evolution of humans with their hands on keyboards and the way they carry out their attacks and the tooling they use, the sometimes stealth and sometimes not at all stealth, which helps with detection, it leads to a situation where for years, the IT community trained ourselves, all of us, that you identify ransomware via the following. Almost all those things are now what you'll find at the payload stage, at the very tail end of the attack. So if your prevention is, I have an endpoint protection or an antivirus, right? Evolved antivirus is all that is. EPP, endpoint protection. All right. It's your newer antivirus slash keep bad stuff off your computers, right? Software, basically. And it will detect ransomware. Okay. What do you mean? It'll detect the ransomware payload? You mean the threat actors have already been in your environment for 4 days and they've already stolen all of your information? They've exfiltrated all your important intellectual property. They've stolen your source code. They've stolen your recipe to bake cookies, whatever you do. I don't know, whatever the org does, right? They've stolen your student database, student registration information, student grades, which can be used for further blackmail down the line. Just thought of that one. I know that you have a 1.5 GPA. That could be a problem, right? But so where is your actual detection? Where are you detecting these things? And how late are you to the party? So prevention, can you prevent it outright? No, it's not going to happen. And partly because of the human, it all comes down to a human issue, as far as I'm concerned, really. The ways that these groups get into environments, there are many, many things that we can do to address these avenues and to at least lessen the chance that you'll be hit with ransomware. And I find that a lot of orgs are not doing these things. In most cases, that's why I get the cases. I don't believe I have had a case yet over the past 3 years of consulting, or that we've even had a case yet, where whatever the threat actor did to get in was not something that that our client could not have prevented. The only cases where those really come into play, and even then there's some oddities there, is when it's what's known as a zero-day software exploitation attack. So the term zero-day refers to when there are 0 days of notification for a vulnerability, and for that matter, a weaponized exploit for that vulnerability. To put it in English, if I have a system called Backup Pro, I just made that up, right? If there is a Backup Pro, not that one, I'm making it up. And Backup Pro is running in my environment, and the server is exposed to the internet. If a threat actor has a vulnerability that they've identified, and they have weaponized an exploit, meaning they can actually exploit that vulnerability in order to get remote code execution, RCE as we call it, remote code to run means they can run whatever they want, right? And then from there, it's all downhill. If that is what hit your environment, did you really have a chance to stop that? Well, it depends, right? It depends on your backup, what I call it, backup pro. I forgot what I call it. Your backup pro mechanism. Was it open fully to the internet, or was it open only to the 3 or 4 IP addresses that need to actually have backup network-based communications? Oh, it was open to the entire internet. Why? Well, when we configured it, documentation for the product says open it on the firewall. Okay, well, it should have said open it only to the 3 or 4 locations, you know, whatever it may be, that you need it open to, not the entire internet. Oh, well, okay. And then you go, well, for that matter, was it exposed to every IP out there possible? Yes. Okay. Was it exposed on all ports? Oh, yeah. We opened the whole thing. So every port on that device was open to the internet. Okay. Well, doesn't Backup Pro, and again, it's a fake product, right? Doesn't it only require like 3 different network ports out of the 65,535 that are available? And you go, yeah. Okay. Well, why didn't you only have those open? Oh, well, we didn't think of it that way. So even if it's a software exploit for which there is no current fix, and for that matter, the world may not even know about, right? There are still other mitigating things you can do for prevention. And if you don't mind, I'll take the Kaseya attack because I have a great example on that. You mind if I run down with that real quick?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Fire away.
So Kaseya is a company that provides a bunch of products. They're a software company. They primarily focus on IT management, if you will. And they make software that is very, very useful for what is known as managed service providers, or MSPs. There's also the managed security services provider that are oftentimes confused with and or used synonymously with the managed detection and response, or MDR. Yeah, we have a gazillion acronyms and they're all fun to try to memorize. So let's just put it this way. An MSP, they do your IT for you if you don't have an internal team. An MSSP, they do your security monitoring for you if you don't have an internal team. If you can't afford one, if you don't have the training, the institutional knowledge to train one up, if you could afford one, all the above, right? So these groups, they run your IT infrastructure remotely, right? Remotely is the key thing here. By attacking an MSP or an MSSP, you then might obtain access to every one of their darn clients. If they're a large MSSP, that could be thousands, maybe even tens of thousands. So Kaseya, they made software, and I'm going to make it really, really simple here. They made software that is geared for MSPs that allows them to manage all of their clients. In that software, there was found a vulnerability. At the time, it was what is we call a zero day, meaning even if I was an MSP, and even if I ran Kaseya's virtual remote software, I wouldn't even know, hey, I have to go patch this. I have to keep my update cycle short time-wise. There's no opportunity for that. All of a sudden, it just hit out of nowhere, right? So what happened? Well, threat actors were able to manipulate, well, without getting technical, they were able to use the software that these MSPs were using from Kaseya to then push malware to their MSP clients. Now, the reason that many of these organizations around the world got hit with ransomware, by the way, in these Kaseya ransomware attacks is because they lacked preventative controls elsewhere. An example of that, some of them had a folder where the Kaseya product might push software. What I mean by that is if I use a software mechanism that is used for what we call deployment, software deployment, right? I need to be able to tell, hey, you 200 hosts or you 20,000 hosts or 200,000, whatever, in my environment, hey, I'm going to give you this, install it. That's your buddy now, right? That's how that works out. If I push that software before it can be installed, it has to be copied to the system, right? So we call that deploying the software. What many times we find is that organizations will identify where some of their products, security or otherwise, where they store files, and they will go into their endpoint protection programs, or they will go into their antivirus or whatever system that might be, whose job is to stop the malware. And they'll say, hey, that folder, Kaseya, and only Kaseya uses or ever will use that folder. So ignore that. Don't look for malware in that folder. I don't want you to mess up my software deployments. So in other words, wherever Kaseya's manager was configured to push software in a given environment is often what we call whitelisted within your security controls. And you basically tell your security controls, don't worry about anything that comes from Kaseya. Well, that becomes a big darn problem when Kaseya is then used to push malware to you. So we had a couple clients that called in and they were like, yeah, this happened. Like our product clients, like they had BlackBerry Silence Protect. And they were saying, hey, I got hit with this. What the heck? And immediately we went and checked. And every one of them that I heard about, personally that I heard about, and it was only a couple, by the way, but I did hear about them. They had it configured. They had a big, bold exclusion, right? In our product, Silence Protect. Do not look at this folder. Ignore it. It doesn't exist. And they were wondering, then, well, how did I get the malware? Like, well, you ignore the folder. Well, only Kaseya uses that folder. Yeah, but Kaseya's product is the one that sent you the malware. Well, how'd that happen? It was a zero day. Well, how do I prevent that? Well, you don't whitelist directories outright, completely, just because some third-party software likes to use it. Done, right? Like, that's how you prevent that. And there are a number of additional examples of this. Are you ever going to stop phishing, right? Or we're pulling away from Kaseya. That was my primary example of why that was extra devastating, along with the fact that many servers, let me go back to Kaseya, many servers for which Kaseya had endpoint pushing enabled, right? The threat actor says, hey, go malware, go to that server there, right? And that particular server didn't even have antivirus or didn't even have endpoint protection, right? Why not? Oh, it should never be used for anything except for as part of our software deployment process. Okay. Well, what about when a threat actor uses your software deployment tool against you? Like, oh, well, we didn't think of that. Oh, yeah. Well, that's why you're where you are now. Like, that sucks. Those types of preventions translate outside of just the zero-day world, right? And 0 days, by the way, are not a huge percentage. In fact, they're a very small percentage of ransomware attacks on a day-to-day basis. Rather, they are software vulnerabilities that have existed for days, weeks, months, or even years. I had a case recently where a vulnerable device sat for about a year before it was eventually popped. And that technically, it was popped a couple months into the world knowing about it, and it was a coin miner was installed. Which in that case, it literally was just a coin miner, which uses system resources to try to basically magically generate money for the threat actors. It's a pretty way of saying that if you're not familiar with coin miners, for anyone listening, you're mining crypto coins by using mathematical computations. You're taking over the CPU, but you're not like stealing data outright, if you will, right? So later, a threat actor got back in to the device and then deployed ransomware. So in many of these cases, it's unpatched things for which there are patches in many, in most of these cases. But let's pull back to another massive, massive entry point, entry vector for malware, and that's phishing, right? What prevention can you implement for phishing? Number one is user training. You train your users over and over and over and over. And then again and again, I'll stop here, but you continually train them and you give them active phishing test campaigns. And if they fail it, you let them know in a very polite way, hey, how dare you? No, but you let them know like, hey, here's what you could have just done. Like, just a heads up. You could have brought the entire company to its knees. Please don't do that again. Here's another module for you to go through. Like, let's learn you up a little more. I mean, how often have you heard, Sean, of phishing attacks? Like, how often do you hear about them?
Daily.
You're like, hourly? Minutely?
Like, well, but there's something interesting about what you just said, right? So there's a public school system here in North Georgia, northwest part of the state, and they have implemented cybersecurity training for their employees, right? And let's say they ran a phishing simulation and 30 members of the staff were caught. They gave the wrong answer. They double-clicked on the executable or whatever. So they pulled those people aside and then kind of coached them up. And then they did another simulation and it was like 8 out of 400 that actually fell for the okey-doke, so to speak. So I think there's hope, and it's coming at people not in a, hey, you're going to lose your job and, you know, your benefits. Learn how to be more cyber safe. It is, we all bear the responsibility, every one of us in the organization, from, you know, if it's a college, from financial aid and bursar, to admissions, alumni relations, like it doesn't matter. Like we all bear the responsibility to make sure that we keep that attack vector as small as we possibly can. So I just wanted to kind of throw that in there.
Yes, we all bear the responsibility, right? So many people look at phishing, including me for many years, right? As I first started here, as a completely human problem, but yet with the user who receives the phishing message. However, what does a phishing attack consist of these days, especially as related to ransomware? There may be an attachment. That attachment may be malicious itself. It may, like a .exe, right? An executable, Windows executable, or program just attached to an email. First off, if your security team has not blocked .exes from getting into your environment via email, that's like a huge problem right there, right? I implore everyone, a bunch of groups are going to hate me for this, but I stand by it. I implore everyone, take a text file, just say hello in it and name the file .exe, not .txt. Send it to yourself an email. See if you get it. If you get it, you got a problem. Email systems can analyze files based on their file name, like just the suffix. And they can, some of them, the better, more expensive ones, can usually also look at the actual file itself and determine, oh, wait a minute, this is named like the opposite, right? This is named.txt, but this is not a txt file. This is an executable file, right? And the email might say, hey, I sent you a legitimate.txt, download it, rename it from legitimate.txt to legitimate.exe, and then double click it. And the user goes, okay. You're like, why wouldn't they do that, right? Sounds legit. So, you have the onus of security throughout. You have the email folks setting up proper filtering. Are they blocking certain file types that are known to be bad? Are they mitigating other file types that for business purposes, we can't block, right? But are we dealing with that in some other way, shape, or form? And for that matter, what if there's a link in the email and that link then goes out to a third-party file sharing site and that site then has an archive, like a zip file? Right? Do you have protections for that kind of thing? Probably not. If that zip file comes down to the host, what's in the zip file? Right? In Windows, when you double click a .zip, which is, by the way, originated with pkzip. I think I want to say it's Phil Katz originated the idea of zip. And it's a compression methodology. We call it an archive. You take a folder, you take a bunch of folders, take a bunch of files, whatever. You put it into a zip file. You compress it. You save space on disk, but you end up with a single archive, as we call it. Technically, you could have multi-split archives, but ignore that for now. A phishing attack may have a zip file. that zip file can be hosted on an innocuous site like a Microsoft Blob, which is their data sharing, cloud sharing. It could be on Box or Dropbox or Apple. Hold on, I almost said Apple Drive. Wait a minute, that's confusing two very large competitors. Better yet, Google Drive or even, does Apple have an open file sharing? That's all tied to Apple accounts. Anyway, it could be on any number of these file sharing sites, right? You're not going to block all access to Google Drive and your environment. I highly doubt that. So a link comes in, user clicks on it. They go to Google Drive. There's a file there. They download it to their computer. Now where's the onus? The user has already made a boo-boo. They made a little whoopsies, or as I call it, a silly click or a series of silly clicks. So if they've silly clicked, right? I'm going to try to get that going. Hashtag silly click. At that point, the onus is now on IT security and what they've done and how they've configured that system. So some examples, many organizations do not have the following implemented, right? This is from being an incident responder. I'm just going to mention some of the things that you should be doing and that I know that most of you are not doing, right? If I have a file that ends in .js, that's a JavaScript file. Okay. For most people, JavaScript, you may know it as the scripting engine that runs client side in your browser. Meaning if a company wants to, you know, do some whiz bang fancy fun stuff on their website, they will often embed what's known as JavaScript into their, you know, their coding for their web page into the HTML. And then when you view it in your browser parses the JavaScript and then makes the pretties fly around, windows jumping out at you, whatever, right? JavaScript can run natively in Windows. Windows actually implements what's known as JScript, which is the Microsoft version of EMCA script, which is the industry standardization for the JavaScript standard. That's a big mouth, I sound smart way of saying, if you double click a JavaScript file, Windows will run it. Windows actually executes JavaScript. Not many people know that. I know that because a couple of years ago, someone double clicked and I was like, what just happened? So Windows has a scripting host engine and it will just run the JavaScript. So what if a threat actor sends an attachment, a .zip file via email, and the email looks real good and tells the client, hey, you got an invoice here. You know, we're charging you $17,000 or whatever. And they go, nuh-uh. And they download that zip file. They double click it. Does Windows pop up and say, you've just opened a zip compressed archive. I'm going to show you the contents. No, it opens like a regular folder, right? It actually just opens it right up. And if the user then sees an invoice 5522.js, are they even looking at the .js part? No. For that matter, by default, Windows, because Microsoft made this wonderful decision, by default, Windows 10 and 11 will both hide the file suffix from users. So they won't even see the fact that it says .js. They'll literally just see something that says invoice and then some numbers or whatever it's called. When they double click on that, what happens? By default, a .js file will invoke what is known as wscript.exe. It is a scripting engine handler. It will run and execute that code. What will the code do? Whatever that phishing attacker wants to do, right? Download like legitimate bad malware, like whatever they want to do. But what if your IT department has gone into Windows and changed what's known as a class handler? It's in the registry. It's very simple. It's called a class handler. Basically, they've modified the class type for a .js file that anytime you double click it, instead of the default WScript opening and thus handling the file and thus running the bad code, what if it just opens in Notepad? If you've done that very, very minor thing, then your users who may inadvertently and, you know, silly click and double click on a .javascript file, what will happen is Notepad will open and they'll see the attack code and have no clue what it does. But you know what? It's not running. So those little types of things are extra layers of prevention. Now, some people like to argue and say, well, that's not the original path prevention. I'm like, it's still prevention. Get out of here. So if a user brings malware down to the host, should they even have got it in the first place? Is your email security gateway configured appropriately? And if anyone is interested, if you go to, let me actually verify this before I say it. Yeah. If you go to FOR528.com. That's the name of my ransomware course, FOR528.com/blocklist. Block list, one word. it'll actually redirect you to a Google document that I have published out there, and it's called Email Gateway File Block List. You click on the tab that says Block List, and I give you a listing of, I don't know, what is this, 50, 60, something odd, file types that you should be blocking in your email security gateway. You should not be letting these files into your environment via email. I personally don't think many attachments at all should be allowed to come in your environment via email. For example, I often hear people say, well, we can't block a .docm file. That's a Microsoft Word file. Like, well, actually, .docm is a macro-enabled Microsoft Word file. Why do you need that? Oh, HR or taxes or, you know, whatever. They need macros. They need to be able to send those to whomever, and they may send them to general users. And I say, that's cool. So we're sending tax documents via email? What are you talking about? Why is your organization not specifically using a multi-factor enabled cloud or otherwise based file sharing utility? Why are they not using that? Why are they using email to send these documents? So that's a little bit of a grudge I have against a lot of these accepting anything.
So Ryan, I have said block list pulled up, and I am going to ask you, sir, a .doc extension and then the macro enabled. I get that, but so I shouldn't send you I can't send you my resume in Word, in a Word document, if I'm in HR. I guess help us understand why you've got the .doc extension, file extension blocked, or you're recommending, strongly suggesting
yes,
that it not be allowed through.
So a couple things. This is a work in progress. In my eventual end state, which I probably will never have, I would love to have a column. It's actually, I have a column there. It's just empty for everything. It says reasons to block. And then next to that is general notes and cited examples. Without having a lot of that, the general IT crowd may be like, why are we doing this, right? My goal there is to explain all of this for each of those. Obviously, I haven't done it yet. But there's also a priority column that is filled out along with the business impact. So if you look at the .doc, it shows in here, I wrote for priority is level 2 for just a .doc. .docm should be, one or two. But business impact is a 5. Like if you just outright block that, that's a very heavy business impact. Like really with that? So the goal here in my mind, any file types, any files that you're sharing throughout your organization should be shared through an official file sharing utility or suite. You know, you may have an approved one at your work. You may be a Microsoft shop, as we like to call them, you know, folks with nice big E5 licenses for everyone in their org or E3 or whatever you've got. And you should be using OneDrive or even SharePoint for that matter, right? So share your documents via these systems that are designed for document sharing. Don't share them via email. I hate seeing critical information in email because also the two largest impacts to organizations where they come to groups like myself and need incident response, ransomware is actually number 2. Number 1 is business email compromise. We call it BEC because, again, we have acronyms for everything, right? But what is business email compromise? It's exactly what it sounds like. It's when someone compromises a business email system, right? A single account, multiple accounts, every darn account. In those situations, when you have a BEC case, what you often will hear in the news and the media is, you know, the classic Nigerian prince scams, right? Where, hey, I got this thing, I need you to, you know, email me back and whatever. Those have evolved over time. They're really good these days. Some of them are really, really good and very, very scary. And one thing that we don't think about a lot because we hear about money scams, right? Because that's what most of them are. They're fraud-based. You know, oh, hey, this is so-and-so's executive assistant, the CEOs or whatever. I need you to wire this amount of money to this bank. He's on a trip and needs this like in the next hour. Go do it. You know, that's a common example of a business email compromise. In that case, they're not even getting access to your email, right? They're just basically saying, send us money, and you send money and then boom, you're out the money, right? There goes $1 million. The bank can't pull it back because you took 5 days to report it. Sucks for you. Right? Something like that. Other business email compromise cases, though, involve credentials being exposed and utilized by threat actors. So overall, I consider nothing in email secure. Oh, that's just me. And many of us in the security community feel the same way. So some groups have secure email mechanisms or tools that they broker files and or just regular communications going over email. Even those are better than simply attaching something to an email. I am a huge opponent. Not, I almost said proponent. No, the other one. Opponent of just sending any type of business documents and attaching them to emails. Share them using methods you have that are designated for file sharing. And those systems should be multi-factor enabled. So if you use, if your group pays, let's just use box.com, right? They're a common one. If your company is like, okay, we're all going to use box.com for stuff, right? Everyone gets access. You get your own folder. You can share files. You can allow people to access them individually. You can give a link for anyone to access, whatever. If you have a system like that, then why the heck are you attaching something to email? In most of those cases, the feedback that I get is, well, what about when it's someone outside the company? And my response to that is, okay, in that system, have them make an account and then share it with that account, which is what many groups do with like Box and Dropbox and Google Drive and whatever, right? There are other systems out there that are far more secure. Like my company, BlackBerry, we make one called Workspaces. In fact, is this still called Workspaces? Changes names kind of often here. Hold on. But regardless of that, the point is its entire purpose is secure file sharing. And you can have it be multiple access or a multi-factor access so that even if someone's password gets out, they still need to have a physical token or their phone or, you know, access to a tertiary email account or whatever in order to access that information. So the ones I have a business impact very high rated on, my eventual design is to put like, hey, why do you still block these kind? Here's why you should be using these mechanisms. So hopefully that answered that general question.
That does, Ryan. And so, man, this is one of the reasons why you have fast become one of my favorite people. One, you take us to honestly a dimension of understanding that you have to pay for. I mean, let's keep it a buck, right? You share information and you go to a level where most people would have to fly to Vegas or fly to the Bay Area, right? And you're paying for this information. And you just gave such a tremendous answer and shared so freely. And so honestly, bro, appreciate you doing that.
Yes, that goes back to what I believe we truly need to do as a community. And I'll level with you. I'll be dead honest with you, fully transparent. I have that new Sans course out, right? My course is not, you would never call it cheap. And many wouldn't even call it affordable by the individual. It is expensive. If you look at the price, you'd be like, oh, really, Ryan? That course has taken 14 and a half months of working around the clock, mostly 7 days a week, in addition to my primary job. Like there has to be, to some degree, I was like, I have to monetize this thing. Here's the perfect avenue. Let's get it out. I love the fact that I have it. I think a lot of organizations are going to be able to hopefully write off a lot of that training and bring their folks in and really get a firm handle on like the most advanced topics in dealing with ransomware. Meanwhile, as much as I can go out there and evangelize, like, hey, block these damn things. Like, why are you not blocking these things? Right. And I, you know, as much as we can get out the general, like, don't do these things or do these things, the better. And a lot of folks just don't have the technical know-how in their environment or the money to hire it, which is the same thing, really. Again, it all boils down to money, right? To really know how to prevent ransomware. And there are a lot of things that we're not doing. Another example that because I'm dying to say this one, so I got to keep going for a minute. Let's say that, let's go with email again, right? Phishing. A user, this would also apply to a USB drive, by the way, but let's just say that a phishing email comes in to your organization. Say 10,000 people get it, or say two people get it, or one, whatever, right? And one of those people does a little silly click and right. How devastating is that going to be? Well, let's just say that it was a link. You know what? Let's just say it was an attachment, a .zip attachment. You double click it and there's a .exe in there. And that is actually a remote access Trojan that will then allow the threat actor to remotely connect to that machine. And then from inside your network, now they're inside the house. The call's coming from inside the house. Now they'll be able to carry out whatever attacks they want on the inside and cause real big problems once they start getting to your server infrastructure, right? So that .exe file, when the user double clicks the zip file and double clicks that .exe file, what other prevention do you have on that host? One of the number one things I've seen organizations do that has made the largest impact on positively on prevention is not allowing, so usually they have to disable it because most orgs have it on now, so don't, is disabling all of their users as being administrators on their machines. What I mean by that is most of our world, right, and this applies not just to Windows machines, by the way, it applies to all OSs I can even think of. But in Windows, we call it administrator rights, right? An admin, if you will. When you have a workstation, right? A desktop, whatever you want to call it, or you have a laptop, you have 10 laptops, I don't care. If you log into a Windows environment and you work for a corporation and you put in your username and your password, usually, we see it more commonly than not, your account has been provided administrator privileges by your organization. Stop it. That's a horrible, horrible idea. Now, I'll tell you exactly why we see that. But before I get to that, here's what it causes. If malware runs, it runs under the context of the user account that executed it, that ran it, right? Meaning if I'm Ryan and I get an email and I'm logged in as my Ryan account and I go double click and then I go, what's that? Double click, right? I silly click a couple times. That malware is now going to be executed as Ryan. It's going to execute under what we call the context of my account. If I am an administrator and I have admin rights on that PC, now guess what? The malware does too. And if you have administrator rights, your job of destroying that environment or your job of using it, you know, leveraging that as a jump box, if you will, to get into the rest of the network, your ability to dump credentials out of memory, your ability to rifle through that user's entire catalog of data or whatever is exponentially greater if you are an admin. Now, conversely, if your users are not administrators, it makes it much more difficult for the malware to then do its intended job. Not impossible, by the way, but much more difficult. And it will thwart many different types of attacks. Now, it's cute for me to say, take all your users, right? Make a what we call a global policy object, an Active Directory. That's the system that runs your network environment in a Windows realm. Say, make a GPO, as we call it, which is basically like a configuration change that you push out into the environment. And in that GPO, take every user and do not allow them to be an admin on their respective machines. That's easy for me to say, and that's what you absolutely should do. But there will be fallout from that. So what do users need administrative rights for? To install software, to install drivers, to install a new printer, to do all kinds of things that Windows, the operating system, decides, well, I need you to be an admin for that in order to do that. So many groups don't have the help desks available to take calls from people all freaking day long. Like, hey, I need to install this program. I need to install this. Like, hey, I'm a chemical mixologist and I need this freaking program that calculates science or whatever, right? That was a great example. I know. I need it installed. I can't install it. I'm not an admin. What the heck? And now you have to worry about, now you have to help them, right? So there are identity access management software products out there that provide what they sometimes refer to as elevation management. In other words, if I'm a user and I want to be an admin on my machine for a given period of time, I have to go click somewhere. Or when I try to do it, it'll pop up and say, hi. Say, hey, Ryan, in order for you to be an admin for the next 10 minutes or just to carry out this action you've requested or whatever, I need you to give me your username and your password and a number I just sent to your work phone, right? A multi-factor number. That user enters that information. They are now allowed to install that software, that print driver, that whatever, right? Meanwhile, the malware that they just downloaded and double-clicked on, when it tries to elevate, right? Could they technically do the same darn thing? Yes, they technically could. But the idea is that you're reducing the overall attack surface because if your users are not administrators, then the things that they execute when they really shouldn't be cannot do as much damage. And it's a single change. It's a massive, massive benefit, but it also is going to be a bunch of tuning in your individual environment. So those types of things, to me, still fall under prevention. That's still preventing ransomware via phishing. And there's many of those types of things to worry about.
Wonderful answer, Ryan. And so I appreciate that. I do want to kind of flip the script a little bit. Not too much, but when you think about these schools and colleges, they're always looking at free. And so one of the things here is companies like BitSight and KnowBe4, you know, are offering free versions of their software to school districts, higher ed, and all that. So for those that aren't aware of those two companies, KnowBe4, they offer cybersecurity awareness training, training simulations, and then BitSight is kind of a cybersecurity credit score tool where they will tell you, and they will look at your computing environment, they will look at your network, and then they will come back and give you a score out of so many hundreds of points, you know, kind of like your FICA, you know, or your TransUnion score. And in so doing, it lets you know that you're more vulnerable from a cybersecurity perspective, or you're less vulnerable. I have some thoughts around both of those, but I will defer to you, Ryan, to talk about what your thoughts are, especially, you know, again, given that school districts are looking for free tools, right? They're looking for things. And, you know, and there are things out there that are helpful, but I would love to get your thoughts on KnowBe4 and BitSight relative to what they offer and how they're doing with K-12 and higher ed.
Yes. So first off, before I get to BitSight and KnowBe4, I do want to mention two things. One is that I never got into the PISA crew, so I apologize for anyone sitting there going, dude, you never talked about it. We may circle back to talking about them. If not, I'll at least give you a link to check out towards the end here. We're getting a little long in the tooth so far, so my apologies. The other thing is I wanted to mention, there are many free, along with free and open source, or as we call FOSS, F-O-S-S, free and open source, right? Another acronym, because why not? Alternatives to many of the commercial products that are out there, they may be free, but they're not free. Because you don't just click a button and all of a sudden it's installed in your environment, configured exactly the way it should be in your environment, and so on and so forth, right? You typically need the computing resources to run these things, and then you need the people to maintain them, let alone install, configure, and then tune out all the noise. So there are many different free utilities and tools that can be used. There are many of them out there, many, many, many. And yet we often see that they're not being leveraged and organizations simply because they don't have the time to deal with it all. If you don't have what's known as endpoint detection and response, or EDR, you don't have, my company makes one, BlackBerry. We make BlackBerry Optics. It's something you install alongside Protect. Protect is our endpoint protection. Optics is our endpoint detection and response. So it can look at what the hacker may be doing on a machine, or what commands are being run, as opposed to the actual like binaries, right, that are running on a system. So let's just say that you want an EDR, but you don't have the money to pay for one. Okay, well, in that case, you've got an EDR provided. It's now actually owned by Alien Vault. I'm totally messing up the name right now. I thought it was Awesome, but now I'm totally blanking on it. Mid-call, which is, Awesome, OSSIM. It stands for Open Source SIM. So the Open Source SIM, actually, this is more of a SIM/EDR integration that people can buy, as opposed to paying for like a commercial product, right? In most cases, the commercial product is going to be easier to tune to the environment if you allow the commercial entity to do that for you. Because you otherwise have to have a development team to stand up servers, install software, and so on and so forth. So let's go back to BitSight and KnowBe4. BitSight and KnowBe4 are two very large players in their respective markets. Actually, they're the two of the biggest in their respective markets. Let's start with KnowBe4. KnowBe4 provides a bunch of services that are commercial, right? Commercially provided. They're not, again, another example of you're getting what you pay for. They're not cheap, right? I'm not saying that they're overly expensive. I'm just saying they're not, it's $20, I'll get KnowBe4, right? That's not how that works. So one of their main competitors used to be called FishMe, and now they're called Cofence, or Coffence. I think it's Cofence. I've used both of them, and they're phenomenal. They're both phenomenal. They provide training resources. They provide entire security awareness programs. So not just like a module or two for your users to go through, but a lot more than that. They provide tooling and mechanisms. KnowBe4 provides a great one that integrate with, for example, Microsoft Outlook and provide a little button. And when you click on that button, it helps users report fish to you, right? Potential fish, or like this is obviously a fish, which is one of the most important things you could train your users to do, by the way, is to, if they don't know for a fact, if they don't look at that email and go 110%, yep, that's my buddy, I need to read this and pay attention to it, then they should report that dang thing, right? And let the security operations center or whoever triages those handle it. KnowBefore even has a tool called PhishER, and its entire purpose is to assist with automating the process of reviewing those reported emails. So they also have products that overall will test your user base. So not just training per se, but automated, and you can configure things, but automated methodologies of sending out a bunch of emails to whom, to which distribution lists or which people or which departments. You can configure all that, right? And what do you want it to say? And all they have a bunch of pre-canned templates and messages. And then if the user clicks on something silly, right, it has a very appropriate response, not a Ryan response. How dare you, right? And it shows them like, hey, let me just show you what you just did. If this were a real threat, this would have been bad, right? How bad? This bad. So those products, KnowBefore, for in this example, it's phenomenal. Them providing services to universities, to any type of educational institution, prior to or even following a ransomware attack or other large scale attack, fan-freaking-tastic. I love it. Absolutely love it. Even if that organization, I've had some folks say company A is only providing their product free to this institution that was hit with ransomware for a year. And then after that, they have to pay for it. Whatever. They have it free for a year. Shush. Over that year, how much are they going to learn about everything that product has to offer, right? If I had KnowBefore for free within an organization, you would learn so much about how they do what they do. And then when it comes to the budgetary meeting the year following, well, you know, the 6 months, because we have to plan almost a year ahead every time, right? Then, or is it something we actually want to continue commercially? Or is it something that we've just learned a lot from and has helped protect us? And we're going to use that to move forward, right? I love KnowBefore. I stand behind their products, their services. I don't know. I have like one contact who works there. He's cool. I don't know about their general employee base or what their salespeople are like, but I know their products and I know that they're pretty darn good. I also love Cofence, which is, again, their biggest competitor. I love both of them. KnowBefore is a little better known. Actually, it's a lot better known in the industry. They do a darn good job of putting themselves out there, and I'm glad that they do so. So some organizations, they put a lot in the marketing, and we're like, right? But in this case, KnowBefore is awesome.
Well, a couple of things. One is, yeah, I mean, they just went public, or maybe they didn't go public. Maybe they just got a funding round. One of the two. And so, you know, basically they are large and growing, and they do a good job of, like you said, providing those tools. The other thing is, I think, I love how detailed you are as far as every tool that you have at your disposal. And in these two particular cases, the Department of Education is the one that's paying for the licenses and then making it available. You know, that notwithstanding, I love what you said about, you know, take advantage of that length of time that you have it. If it's a 6 month opportunity, a year, right? Because at the end of that time, you have a couple of decisions, right? If you decide to pick it up, then you know what you've been using for the last year and probably get a pretty sweet discount. But then, you know, to your other point, if you decide, hey, you know, this has been great, then you've got that 6 or 12 months worth of learning. You've got the case studies, if you will, of what it was like to use that in your environment. And then, like you said, you're all the better for it. So yeah, love what you said about KnowBefore. What are your thoughts on BitSight?
So BitSight is a bit of a different story. And I'll just start with basically step one. I very recently, in the past couple of days, have engaged in conversations with some folks who are people that I would trust over many others in the general industry, if you will, right? So, you know, you run in certain circles, you have certain people, and in one of those circles, I decide, let's talk about BitSight. So the way that BitSight itself works out, first off, having their services compared to not having their services or anything like them, massive, massive positivity behind that. Fantastic data that can be provided and a great, great resource from what I can tell, right? I have not used it personally, so let me keep that in mind. The way that they provide their reports to their clients, the way that they gather their data, the way they amass it and analyze it from a third-party perspective, it all looks great, especially if you don't have a service like that. So for anyone not in the know, BitSight, what they try to do is provide, just like you mentioned, a type of kind of like a credit score in the sense of your IT security maturity level, right? How secure are you? Now, the way that they do that is where there's a bit of hesitancy on my side for a number of reasons. But what they do itself is awesome. So they use externally available data like telemetry that would be available to review from external to internal through an organization's internet presence in order to make determinations about that organization's security level. So they look at all the things they could possibly look at. And apparently, I've talked to a couple of these cohorts of mine, and they have very positive things to say about some of the people who work over there at BitSight. Some folks I don't know personally, but if you know, some of these people are like, trust me, they're awesome. Like, okay, that means they're awesome, right? So what they do, let's give an example, okay? How do they judge? They provide one of the things they give in their reports, right? An overview of your security posture is they look at your patching cadence, your patching cycle, right? Are you patching quickly enough? Now, the way that they look at this, remember, everything is from an external to internal perspective. Now, when I say to internal, that's actually not correct. I mean external to external, technically, right? They don't put sensors within your environment. They're looking at network traffic going in or out of your environment, right? But they're not at the edge of that environment. So if I'm trying to judge someone's patch cycle, right? How do I do that externally? Well, I run scans against them. And there are sites such as Shodan and Census is one of them. Here, I'll type it out for you so you can put it in your show notes. Shodan and then Census. So Shodan.io, S-H-O-D-A-N, Shodan.io is a website that specializes in scanning the entire internet often and over and over and over, looking for vulnerabilities. And for that matter, looking to see what we call ports are open. So in the networking world, in order to connect to a device, you have to connect to a port and its networking stack. There are 65,536 technically, but there's 535 ports. Many of them are commonly associated with given technologies. When you open a web browser and you type in, for example, shodan.io, my web browser resolves the IP address for Shodan, that domain name, that's a domain name. It finds the proper address, and then it reaches out to that address on port 443, because that is the default port for hypertext, HTTPS, what's it called? Hypertext protocol secure layers, right? With SSL. Meaning, my web browser knows you want to go to their web browser, that's going to be on port 443, right? Other services have well-known ports. Remote desktop protocol, the default port is 3389. If you have a website and I take that website and I find the IP address that's behind it, right? The server that's actually providing or hosting that web page. And I do what's called a network scan against that IP. Depending on how strong my scanning skills are and which tools I'm using, I should be able to determine what ports. And using that information and along with what we call banner grabbing or doing some type of lower level analysis, like trying to reach into the port and saying, hey, what service are you? Often the services will go, oh, hi, I'm SMTP. I'm used to send mail. What do you want? And I go, oh, cool. SMTP is open on that, on this IP. Thank you. Right. That's what this service does. And that's also what BitSight does, but they do it at a grand scale. And they also archive data over time. And they use that to establish baselines. And that's how they determine your patching cadence. That's one of the ways they do it. So let's just say that you have VMware Horizon running in your environment. Do you have port 8443 open? That's the default port for Horizon. If you have that port open and our scanner, right, Shodan scanner in this case, is able to hit that port and get a response back, it goes, oh, You're VMware? Okay. What do you think about this? And it will send an attempted exploit, a testing-based attempted exploit for all the currently known vulnerabilities, right? All the ones for which there are most likely patches. And all of those should come back with a, no, go away. Right? That's a cute way of saying it, right? But obviously a little more technical, but they'll respond hopefully with a, no, go away. If they respond with, okay, that works. Now, what do you want to do? That's a big darn problem. In which case, BitSight would note, there's a server that's owned by your company, company A, I'll go back to company A, and it's sitting at this IP address that you say you own. It's running VMware Horizon that happens to be vulnerable to an exploit that was published, whatever, 2 months ago, 11 months ago, 27 months ago, whatever it is. And they provide that within a report. Now, Shodan does all that type of scanning also. I implore everyone out there to take your primary public IPs, pop over to Shodan.io. You can pay for lower level and historical access, but just check your IP space. Check your general, we have a subnet of these IPs. Take your big servers and throw them in Shodan. See what Shodan says. If you find that Shodan says, oh, port 22 is open and it's vulnerable to this open SSH vulnerability, stop and drop now because you've got a big damn problem. All right. Shodan will tell you that. Now, Bitwise will also tell you that, but Bitwise looks much further than just scanning things like a web server and determining whether or not you're patching things in an appropriate fashion, right? Now, one of the things that I'm very cautious of with something like BitSight, your patching cadence determines how often you are patching things. It's very important to understand that someone's BitSight score is based on things that can be seen from the outside. On the inside, do all of your machines have the Firefox browser? Like we use Firefox. We deployed it to all of our machines, right? What version is that browser? They can also see a lot of information about that because every time a web browser makes a call out to the internet, it includes what's known as a user agent string, which of course has an acronym of UAS. So the user agent string, often just known as the agent string, is a string that a web browser almost always, but usually will send when it requests a web page. And that string identifies the client that's being used. In other words, the browser. It usually identifies the browser type and exact version and the operating system under which it's running and the exact version of that operating system. So whenever I request a web page, when I go to Shodan.io on my computer right now, I am sending them information in each web request. Every time I click on something and it says, hi, I'm running on Mac OS 10.16, whatever the heck I'm running. And I'm using Chrome, 97.2.4.3 or something like that. So that information can also be externally seen. And so sites like and services like BitSight can look at that and go, you know what? We see a ton of traffic egressing from this particular client. And it's all like Chrome version 70, which is, however many months old. They're not patching their browsers. That's a bad sign. And that would then impact their score. So they can see a lot. There's a lot of externally available telemetry. But I just think it's very, very important for organizations to realize that a score provided by BitSight or a service like them is not taking into account. And of course, if you've done additional consulting with them and you're going above and beyond the general product offering, right, then it would be different. But you're generally getting a score of what can be seen on the outside. So examples. If you are an insurance agency, and there's one, I'll bring one of them up. It's the Hartford. Everyone's heard of the Hartford in the United States at some point, right? They insurance for everything under the sun. One of those being cyber insurance. The Hartford actually has a ransomware preparedness thing that they do. And let me type it in here. BitSight. Let's see if I can Google it real quick. Oh, there it is. It's actually, you can just Google the Hartford Ransomware Mitigation Suite. And when you look that up, you'll see BitSight is noted in here. They want you to go through a proof of concept with both. Oh, look, both KnowBe4 and with BitSight. They happen to both be in here, right? That's not a coincidence. When I said they're two of the largest players in their realm, right? They're the big boys and girls, right? So what the Hartford does and what other cyber insurance agencies do, they want to get your BitSight score before you sign up with their insurance because it's going to affect your underwriting. How much insurance are they willing to give you? Or are they going to charge you for that insurance, right? It's just like a credit score would be for financing of a new car. You know, what APR you're going to be, what percentage you're going to be paying financing wise. It's the same kind of concept. But there are a lot of security maturity things that are, that there's no way to see from the outside. So it's just very important that that number, like the BitSight number, not be taken for face value at this is exactly how secure this organization is, because that's not the case. It is rather, this is how secure the organization is based on externally observable information. And for many people, there's it's hard to distinguish what you mean by that. So let's give you an example. If an organization gets hit with ransomware, how impacted will they be? Well, do they have endpoint protection installed? How's it configured, right? Are you going to see that from the outside? Possibly not at all. Now, you may see them calling out to certain antivirus cloud-based systems, but they could have an on-premises system, and you would never see that even happening, right? What rule set or signature sets do they have deployed? Does it use machine learning? None of those things are known. What exceptions are in the whitelist? You can't see any of that from the outside. Does that organization have a SIM or a log aggregator, right? Do they even have one? If so, what logs are in it? How far back do those logs go? Are the logs parsed appropriately to make sense? Are the fields understood by the organization's security team? Should they need to respond to a threat? Is there an EDR deployed? How far is it deployed throughout the company? And what's the actual saturation percentage of the installs? All these types of things, you don't necessarily see them from the outside. There are many, many, many things. Oh, here's an example. Are all the users in the environment administrators on their dang machines, right? Are you going to see that from the outside as far as I'm aware of? No. So there are a lot of things that don't go into that BitSight score. But as I've had the discussion with some of my cohorts, when you look at what they're analyzing and you look at the rollout and the report that they provide, right? The deliverable, there's a lot that can be garnered from that. And there's a ton of information that they can provide that many groups will not be familiar with and need to know about. But it's also the kind of situation where they could have a score that might be low, but it's going to require tuning and feedback from your part in order to get that fixed. Because they may say, oh, we see RDP open and we, you know, on this server here. So that lowers your score by whatever. And then you say, well, that's actually open only to a certain subnet or two on AWS. You happen to be connecting from that. I guess you're co-located or whatever. And that's open for a very specific reason. There's only one account that has the craziest password in the world, and it uses three forms of authentication, not just a password, right? So there's tuning involved with that also. But the big thing for me is there's so much on the inside of the environment that BitSight and systems like it don't have any way of knowing. And unfortunately, as far as I know, the only real way of knowing all of these things collectively is using something like BitSight or BitSight, because apparently it's awesome, and also doing a massive internal audit, which most groups, A, don't know how to do, which most regulatory bodies don't know what to look for, and so on and so forth. So I'm just trying to be verbose in that I would not treat a BitSight score or any tool just like it, identical to how it works, right, as a credit score specifically of overall security maturity. It does function pretty darn decently, like pretty well. Like I think it's a great product for the externally available indicators. And when you think about it, when a threat actor is trying to get in the first place, that's what they're going to see for the most part, right? They're going to see what's available from the outside. And so that's what BitSight is looking at. And that's a big reason why their reports can really help you with setting up proper prevention.
Well, Ryan, and I think that's really, so what you shared is what I was really wanting to get at, right? Which is, and you said it beautifully, having know before and having BitSight is better than not having anything at all, right? And so if the Department of Education is paying for the licenses, go ahead and avail yourself of the license, get the tool, make use of it. But don't think that you have touched the wall and you're done, right? You're really at the beginning of your cybersecurity program journey, right? If, I mean, and this is assuming that you have no program at all, right? But, you know, in particular for K-12, the thing that I would highlight is the average school district spends about $20,000 a year on cybersecurity. And not all schools have a $1 million budget. I mean, so really you're talking about against a $1 million budget, that's 2% of your budget. Here in Georgia, those budgets, especially the northern part of the state, they're a lot smaller. All we're saying is take advantage of Shodan.io, census.io, you know, some of the tools that Ryan mentioned. We'll make those available in the show notes. But I want to put a bow, so to speak, on what we've been sharing. I'll harken back to something that Ryan mentioned during our first episode, and that is if you have, let's say, Sentinel One for endpoint protection, or let's say you have, you know, Palo Alto for your firewalls, there is typically some level of support that is baked in to you having Sentinel One or Palo Alto, right? Avail yourself of those resources, right? Like Ryan said in that first episode, hey, call up Palo Alto and say, hey, I'm such and such institution of higher education, or I'm such and such school district. What sort of support comes with the service that you're providing me? And they may say, oh, well, you know, you get 10 hours of tech support a month or what have you. Take advantage of that, right? Ask them to help you better understand your environment and what part they play in it. I mean, you know, have them take you through a tutorial, whatever. Just make yourself available of what's out. You know, make yourself aware of and take advantage of what's available. And so that would be kind of my parting words of wisdom.
Yes. Let me take that further real quick before we wrap up and say, I help run a conference called CactusCon, right? I think I mentioned that more than once already. We are a 501c3 through the United States IRS, right? Because of that, we're a nonprofit, is what I'm saying. Because of that, we are able to get discounts. We're able to get free services. We're able to get a number of things that I didn't even realize when I went in as a lead. I was the official, you know, lead conference organizer for 2 years. And during that time, I just kept finding more and more and more things. I'm like, oh, I wish we could have so-and-so. And I'm like, wait, someone go look. Do they have a thing for us? And we check, and they do. Educational institutions have many of those things also. If there's something that you're looking at and feel, gosh, I wish I could implement that, but yeah, we can't afford it. It's not in our budget. We're a small university, whatever it is. Look into it. Give them a call. Be like, hi, you know, we're so-and-so. We're based here. We've only, you know, say you're a smaller place. We've got, you know, 1,200 students, or, you know, 12,000, 120,000, whatever it is. Let them know where you're coming from and see what they may have available. You might be surprised with what you find.
Ryan, I love what you said. Again, my passion is K-12 and higher ed. I've done FBI webinars for the space. We're getting ready to do a webinar with a good friend of mine at the Department of Homeland Security. We want to enrich the community as much as we possibly can. Right? We, again, being married to a teacher, I know what teachers make, and having a number of friends and people that care about that are on the technology side, I know kind of what their budgets are, right? I kind of know what they're working with. And so anything that we can do to help, we're willing to do that. So Ryan, man, I love you like a big kid loves cake, man. I appreciate you. You are a good friend, a good human being. I can't wait until the next time we do this.
Yeah, I love being here. Thank you very much for having me on. Excuse me, yet again. For anyone who is wondering, like, is he going to talk about the Paisa Crew? You can go check out FOR528.com/PYSA, Paisa, and I'll put it in here in our chat for you to share that out. That's a shortened URL. It'll take you to the DFIR reports overview of the Paisa ransomware group. It is very, very technical in nature. So when you first pull it up, you might be like, what? But just mostly look for the graphics they have on there. There's like a timeline of their the attack that, you know, denoted and that they're documenting. Just give you a feel for the various technologies at play. Anyone who works in IT, especially IT security, look at the things they're using, not even just the tools, but the built-in Windows stuff we call living off the land methods of execution and persistence and all the crazy stuff they're doing. and see if you detect that or prevent it or, you know, whatnot. They're targeting schools, right? So if you're with K through 12, university, whatever it is, like go look. You should be aware of all that. And yeah, that's pretty much it. Thank you for having me on again. And let's do another one. I can run my mouth with you all day, man.
Hey, look, like I said, this is this is what we do. You know, we do it because we love it. And so, Ryan, again, thank you, brother. I appreciate you. We'll put all that good information in the show notes. And Tech and Main Presents family, thank you as always for listening. And be sure to tune in next time when we will have another technology expert share their wisdom. Goodbye for now.
You've been listening to another episode of Tech and Main Presents. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Don't forget to tell your friends, and thanks for being a part of the Tech and Main Presents community.